commercial water system in the United States or in North America and ignore it is something I'd like to talk about today. The system I'm referring to is the freshwater system that flows out of British Columbia along southeast Alaska, south central, and in a sort of a counterclockwise fashion from north to going northward and then westward in the northern Gulf of Alaska. It's an unusual flow because it's freshwater driven. Most coastal flows are wind driven, and the reason that we can have a freshwater driven system in the high latitudes is because of the low water temperatures. And I'll talk a little bit more about this as we go along, exactly how the cold water assists the driving of this freshwater system. What I want to do is to go through and talk about some general flow characteristics in the Gulf of Alaska, and then talk about the forces that affect that flow, and then talk about briefly about some future research that I hope to do in the next couple of years. Some of you will probably have seen the diagrams before. Please bear with me. I have some new stuff at the end. We'll go through the old stuff quite briefly. If I could have the slides on. What I want to begin with is to just a general description of the flow in the North Pacific. The oceanic flow consists of a North Pacific current which bifurcates over about at the state of Washington, the British Columbia Washington border, and bifurcates into the California current and the Alaska current. There is some controversy as to exactly where this turns around once again, and as an aside, we're having crews out there this summer that's addressing that problem as to whether the Alaskan Gyre recirculates and goes southward, south of the Aleutians, or whether it continues on over. But what this is to bring the Alaska current is a warm, relatively warm, salty current flowing northward along the coast. The circulation of that subarctic gyre has always been considered to be, or for a long time been considered to be, in response to the weather systems. The atmospheric system, and I have here the surface sea level pressure for winter and summer, and in the winter the Aleutian low dominates and causes northward winds along the coast of southeast, and then westward winds along the upper part of the Gulf of Alaska. In summertime the winds reverse and we have eastward winds in the northern Gulf of Alaska. The whole system decreases in magnitude. These isobars are much tightly, more tightly packed than these in summer times. So you have an order of magnitude difference in the wind system from summer to winter. This is typified by the next illustration. Here's a low pressure area sitting over the Gulf of Alaska. I'd like to say that's typical, but it's not. It's the remnants of Typhoon Harriet in 1977, I believe. This is in October. It's an 984 millibar low. But this type of system tends to focus one's attention. And this is a type of thing that we were looking at until very recently in addressing the forcing functions along these lines. One thing to note here is how the storm system sort of fits the Gulf of Alaska. For those of you who aren't familiar with the area, here's the Aleutian chain, and here's South southeast, so the low just sits very nicely over the Gulf of Alaska. So what I want to look at initially is the wind forcing in the Gulf of Alaska. We'll concentrate on a section up here in the northern part. This is where most of the OCS work is done, which I'll mention a little bit later. But to get an idea of the annual forcing by the wind system, we're going to look at what we call the downwelling or upwelling index at 60, 149, and 60, 146 over a complete year. So what we're doing is we're measuring the amount of Ekman transport that's either onshore or offshore. And that's due to the winds blowing from the east to west in the northern Gulf. So if we look at that, that's what this illustrates is that we have, this is upwelling index, and what we have is upwelling, a slight upwelling in the summertime, and intense downwelling in the wintertime. So, and with a nearly, with an order of magnitude change from summer to winter. So we pretty well focused on that type of an effect up until a few years ago. And if you look at the hydrographic properties, specifically density, water density at the coast in the northern Gulf, you can see the effect of the wind system. Now this is density, sigma t, plotted versus time from 71 through 74 at Seward. It's at the mouth of Resurrection Bay. And what happens is that during the summertime, when there is a relaxation of the downwelling condition, there's an intrusion of high density water up onto the shelf, right up to the coastline. So you see this intrusion. Now, coincident with that, or nearly coincident with that, is a decrease in density at the surface each year, occurring at approximately the same time. Now, what happened here is that the intrusion of this high density water is a little bit delayed because it takes a while for the wind effect to become apparent. Now the circulation, the general circulation up on the shelf, sort of mimics the offshore circulation, and these are dynamic topography. They can be considered as streamlines. So what we have is a flow that runs along the shelf break. This is the Alaska stream flowing from sort of east to west along the shelf break. Up on the shelf, we have another flow that comes in. It goes around an eddy behind Kayak Island. And I don't have them illustrated here because you couldn't do it with the amount of data we have. But the flow does appear to go on into Prince William Sound and along over past Seward. Seward is here. So essentially have two systems. We have the offshore system and then the nearshore system. One thing to note at this point is that these stations don't go very close to shore. They're considerably offshore. And that'll be important a little bit later. To illustrate the section around Kayak Island, here's a satellite photo. You can see some of the flow that comes, nearshore flow that comes around Kayak Island, and then it appears to go into Prince William Sound. There you can see the eddy vaguely. So that's what the flow tends to look like. Now, what up until this time we considered it as wind driven. 1975, we concentrated on a single station. One other slide illustrating the flow. These are satellite track drifters that were released as part of the OCSEP work, and they confirm this sort of coastal flow that goes around behind Kayak Island and on into Prince William Sound. So what we have is an east to west flow up on the shelf and an east to west flow offshore also. But they appear that they possibly can be separable. Now, if you look at the, as I said just a minute ago, we were concentrating on the wind-driven portion, but on further examination, looking at Station 1 near Seward, you can see that this is Station 1, that it responds we were concentrating on wind-driven circulation, but if you look at the density salinity temperature relationship, here's a TS diagram for the northern Gulf of Alaska, and if you can, with density superimposed on it, and if you look at the change in salinity, it affects density much more than a change in temperature. You have to have a very large change in temperature to have the same sort of effect of a change in salinity. So what we began to wonder is it possible that the system is responding to salinity changes and is something that's driving the salinity possible to drive the system? And so looking at the cross-section of hydrographic properties from Seward out, called the Seward line, you can see that the temperature here has some structure to it. And if you'll note that they're pretty flat, the isotherms of temperature are pretty flat. This is the coastline here, and this is the offshore region here. The temperature has structure out here, note this, and pretty flat in here. But if you look at the density, it has some slope to it, and it doesn't have any structure out here. So it appears that something other than temperature, that is salinity, is driving the density. Now, as I mentioned earlier about the elusiveness of this major freshwater system, here's an illustration that shows the major freshwater system, and it's been around for about 5 years. And initially, we didn't note it. But here's the freshwater system up here at the top of the water column. And most oceanographers are interested in things down in the lower regions of the water column. So if you look at this particular station next to Seward and look at the annual cycle of sea level is the solid curve here, goes up in this manner. Sea level is a minimum in April and a maximum in fall, and here's the precipitation in southeast. Or south central, I'm sorry, that mimics this sort of change in sea level. So what I'm saying is that the precipitation affects the density, which affects the sea level, and it also affects the dynamic height at Seward. Yeah.
On your previous figure, I'm trying to say that we should see the freshwater system from that figure alone?
Pardon?
Are you saying that we should have been able to detect the freshwater system from the previous figure alone?
Yeah, you can see that there is some fresh water here. We just, if I'd known then what I know now about the sources of it, would have concentrated more on it. But I would say that the sort of lack of background. Most physical oceanographers are not accustomed with dealing with freshwater systems. So we're dealing with oceanic systems, and we're more concerned with what's going on out here.
And what are you defining as freshwater? Anything below 25
parts? Yeah, anything below 28 for this system. Okay, so what we've got now is a point at Seward, at the mouth of Resurrection Bay, that responds to fresh water. The next thing that we have to do is to establish that drives the flow in some manner. Simply because the fresh water responds to, or the sea level responds to fresh water, it could be uniform throughout the Gulf of Alaska. The whole Gulf could be moving up and down, and there would be no, if that's the case, then there would be no longshore flow. So what we want to do is to look at the flow along the Seward line by calculating the baroclinic transport. So you need more than one station. These data were based simply on one station, and here is the correlation matrix for that particular station. We can see that these are well, the sea level is well correlated with precipitation, 0.744. And the dynamic height at that coastal station is well correlated with precipitation. And that just confirms what I said in the previous slide. So what we want to do is to look at the baroclinic transport, and what I'm going to do is show you some curve fits of the baroclinic transport data for this particular station line, stations 1 through 11. And we'll do it as station pairs. And here are the transports beginning. It immediately comes off in the form of small streams, and they don't join together to form a major stream network. So what I've done is I've taken the south coast and called it one region, and I've taken southeast and called it another region, and I've combined the two. So the freshwater output that I'm going to be looking at will be applicable for the station at Seward or the Seward line. So what I'm doing is I'm combining the runoff from south central or south coast and combining it with southeast and letting it flow by Seward. Now, I put a phase shift on this. Here's the record, the annual signal of discharge for southeast plus the south coast. Now there's no phase shift in the one at the top. It just peaks a little bit earlier, and there's a 2-month phase shift on this lower panel. And that diminishes the peak, and it puts it back over in about December rather than October, where the 1-month phase shift is.
What did you shift?
Okay, what I did is coming back to the map, I've allowed the southeast runoff to come in, and I've taken into account that it's going to take about a month to get over here. So I've shifted it so that the June runoff from south coast would be combined with the May runoff from southeast. And I believe that the velocity that I've assumed is about 15 centimeters a second, which is, anything, I can't distinguish anything shorter than that. What I'm dealing with are monthly data. So it's sort of an all or nothing thing. So when you combine those two, you get an annual signal in the discharge that has a minimum in February and March, and a maximum in October. So this is what I consider the, my best estimate so far of the freshwater discharge for just southeast and south coast Alaska. Now, the being an oceanographer, it was a bit baffling as to what these numbers meant. And the best comparison I can make is the volume of some known rivers. Okay, the Mississippi River, 18 times 10 to the third cubic meters per second. So here's the Mississippi, which is the largest river in the North American system. So you're talking about a flow that's considered, whose amplitude is sometimes exceeds the mean of the Mississippi. Actually, the mean, the annual mean of this is about 23. So it's greater, I call it 1.2 times the Mississippi River. The Columbia it has a magnitude of 7,500, so it's down here. Now, the other thing is that this doesn't include the British Columbia runoff, nor does it include the output of the Copper River. The Copper River is about 1,000, so it's one of these units. I consider the Copper River the noise level. And it doesn't include any other major rivers such as the Stikine. So if these, I believe this is an underestimate. The numbers that I've been using for input for this, and I'll show you the annual figures here. These are the annual means from 1930 to 1980. 1979, actually. So the upper panel is temperature, a little bit run off the screen there. These are degrees centigrade. So these are the average air temperatures for southeast and south coast. You can see that in the early 30s, there was a very unusual winter where the south coast average air temperature was below freezing the entire year. These are the precipitation values that were used. Now remember, these are the annual means. I actually did use the monthly means, so that you have a very sharp drop-off in precipitation coincident with the low air temperatures, and then an increase and then a gradual decrease. Not an awful lot of difference between precipitation rate. But sort of a mean value, remember I said that there were areas where it was 8 meters, but the value that I'm using is somewhere between 2 and 2.5 meters, generally, for the precipitation. So I feel that I'm in the ballpark. The drainage areas, I think, are correct to within accuracy of course of precipitation. But anyway, the discharge that you get is illustrated in the lower panel. Very low value in the early 30s, 1934, I believe. And then it comes up, and you can see a gradual decrease until the early 70s, and then it comes back up again, and now it's down. But remember, here's the magnitude of the Mississippi down here. So that's what I mean by it's a major freshwater system. Now, this is the month to month, each month from 1930 to 1979, south coast plus southeast discharge lagged by a month. Now, the peak for the Mississippi is 58,000. And the peak here is 62,000, so even the peaks exceed that of the Mississippi. The peak for the Columbia is about 35,000. The maximum, the record maximum runoff for what's what I'm referring to for the Mississippi and Columbia. So what we've got is a system that appears from these computations, probably the largest freshwater system in North America. Now, we've diverted a little bit from the oceanography. And what I want to do in the next slide is to look at this system from 1974 through 1979 and compare it with the baroclinic transport. So here's that section blown up. And it ranges from up to 62,000 cubic meters per second. Now that's the range in the line here. Superimposed on this, I put the baroclinic transports for stations 1 through 7. If you remember on the sewer line, that's about halfway out. And that, I feel confident, covers the entire coastal jet. So what I'm comparing here with the crosses is the transport in the coastal jet, or in the coastal current. Now the range for these crosses, the coastal jet transport runs from 1.3 times 10 to the 6th farragrips to zero here. So those are on a different scale, but what I've done is I've gone ahead and cross-correlated them, and they cross-correlate to something in excess of 99.9% confidence interval between the baroclinic transport along the coast near Seward and this calculated freshwater discharge. Now, one question that probably will come up is why do you have to calculate the discharge and why not you measure it directly? And one of the problems is the streams aren't gauged. There are very few gauged streams in southeast and south central Alaska, so you have to use indirect method to determine that. Now, if we come back to the coastal flow once again and look in detail at what we gathered earlier, here's the detailed section of between stations 2 and 3. 3 would be out here. So Seward is, or the coast is along here, and this is about 10 miles off, or you see that this is about 25 miles offshore. So what we've got is a low salinity upper layer, due to that fresh water, and it's about 25 miles wide, or less than 25 miles wide, I'm sorry. More like less than 20 kilometers wide. Now, this is the geostrophic velocity calculated for that particular station, or that particular section, and you can see that the velocity here is approximately 66 centimeters a second, so the peak velocity in that coastal band. So it's narrow, it's intense. The transport that we see in that coastal band sometimes exceeds 1 sphere, but that is pretty small compared to offshore currents, but it's very large compared to other coastal currents. This is a section that was taken in November to the east of that Seward line, and you can see once again the low density. This is sigma T at 25 parts per thousand, so that there's a low salinity region here. The scale on each one of these tick marks is 2 nautical miles, so we're about 12 miles offshore here, extent of the coastal bank. Now it's a little bit better behaved there because it doesn't have as much stream obstacle the way the sewer line goes. There's a freshwater driven coastal current, and it's due in part to low temperatures, and it's due in part to the vast amounts of fresh water coming into the system. The water enters the system not as a point source, but rather as a line source from southeast all the way around to south central. And it's different than simply river runoff. The coastal mountain ranges not only contribute to the fresh water, but they contain the wind system. So the atmospheric systems cannot penetrate beyond the coastal ranges, and the winds tend to be longshore. So not only do the mountain ranges enhance the amount of fresh water, but they also direct the winds. So it increases the downwelling. So the mountains are important in two aspects, both downwelling and fresh water. There is going to be more refinement with the hydrology model. What I'd like to do is be able to take into account melting and freezing at higher elevations. And another aspect of it is that the glacial fields need to be taken into account. When you're talking about annual precipitation rates on the order of 2.5 meters, what is the melting or accumulation rate in the glacial fields? Now, the glacial fields account for about 20% of the landmass in the coastal area. So if you melt several meters off of a glacier, I'm not sure what the rates are, but you could significantly increase or decrease, and then whether you're melting or accumulating water in the glacial fields. It adds an interesting perturbation to the system. That also tends to make an interesting long-term effect. If the glaciers are advancing
. Ladies and gentlemen, I am most pleased to join you as a member of the Fairbanks community and the North Star Borough, and hope to not only maintain the already good relationships which have been established between the University of Alaska Fairbanks and the community, but to even further improve upon these. I suppose I would offer a compliment first before starting out, and that is, there's an interesting phenomena that I've observed after my 17 years living in different places across this state. The first is, with the exception of our Alaska Native population, in Fairbanks I have met more native-born Alaskans than in any other city in Alaska. Secondly, I have met more people who have stayed in this community, so that probably your average tenure is much longer than any other city in Alaska. And third, those few unfortunate people that I've met around the state who once lived in Fairbanks seem always to be waiting for the right opportunity to return, for they've always considered this home. I think that speaks well of our community, and after 10 years, I guess I too am happy to be home. When I first learned a couple weeks ago that I was to address the Chamber's general membership after a sum total of 3 weeks on the job, I felt that was a little bit audacious, to say the least. For really, I need to listen to you for a long period of time. However, perhaps because of my newness and freshness to this position, it is an ideal time to share with you some first impressions on the state of the University of Alaska Fairbanks, and to indicate to you some initial plans and directions that we might explore cooperatively over this next year. First, I'm happy to report that at the present time, it looks like we are having about a 17% increase in applications and acceptances to the University of Alaska Fairbanks. As of the 21st of this month, we had 3,165 applications, which compared to 2,669 a year ago at approximately that same period of time. Needless to say, this number has caused a number of ramifications for us up on campus. We need a number of additional sections of certain classes, additional faculty, adjunct faculty, additional classrooms, labs, dorms, etc. However, we are coping. But in the future, I think we must improve our enrollment projections so that we can tie them much more closely to our planning system and not be in quite the type of crunch that we are at the present time. I do believe in the service orientation of the land-grant university, which the University of Alaska Fairbanks is, and toward this end, a few weeks ago, we reopened the application and admissions process to the University of Alaska Fairbanks, although the formal date had closed. I do not think we ought to be in a posture of turning away those students who meet our acceptance criteria, and so we are making every effort that we can to process these late applications and to take them in. In terms of the immediate future, I guess this will portend for us some larger classes, certainly increased efficiency on our part and a gradually tighter scheduling. The second problem, perhaps, that we are beginning to experience at the present time is a degree of turbulence and uncertainty in our research institutes. Due to the tightness of the federal budget and the reduction of certain programs, we're not sure exactly what's going to occur over the course of this year. As you may or may not know, approximately 80% of our research effort has been supported by the federal government. However, for that research which is vital to Alaska as it sets its public policy, we will be seeking some increased state support so that our research activities might truly reflect the state needs rather than to be constantly tracking in search of the federal dollar. Third, our summer programs, while slightly improved this summer, I guess I would have to say it's not particularly overly exciting at the present time. As a matter of fact, it's a little bit dull and boring on campus in the summer months. I think we must look much more closely at a trimester system in addition to our regular and special summer sessions. And given our natural environment, I truly believe that over the course of the next few years, we can be a splendid place for summer study, and so that eventually we will make maximum utilization of our facilities by having students here on a year-round basis. Fourth, unfortunately, preliminary review indicates that we are probably not doing the job in the development of Alaskan Native leadership. In almost two decades, our progress appears minimal, and yet these people depend upon this institution almost solely. Some preliminary facts indicate that, one, in 1963, 81% of the Alaska Native students at the University of Alaska Fairbanks did not re-enroll. They left and did not re-enroll. In 1975, almost 12 years later, that figure was still 75%, so there has not been a great deal of progress in that decade. In 1963, 12% of the entering Alaskan Native freshmen had ACT scores of 10 or below. In the late 1970s, 55% of our entering Native freshmen had scores of 10 or below. Somehow we have not been attracting the top quality Alaska Native students across the state. In the late 60s and the early 70s, the number of Alaska Native graduates from the University of Alaska Fairbanks increased dramatically. Late 60s, early 70s. However, this number fell off again in the late 70s. In any event, I hope to reestablish a commitment and find a way to improve this picture. The regional Native corporations, as a group, make up the single largest block of the private economy. And they have asked, and we need to reply with providing them a continuing stream of a trained and educated leadership. Fifth, it appears that we have a number of minor international programs underway, but that we have not addressed as an institution or at the institutional policy level what the University of Alaska, Fairbanks, ought to be doing in the international arena. Alaska is in a key position economically in the world market. We have some natural ties with Asian nations and some common problems with other northern latitude countries. Over the course of this next year, I hope to examine our institutional purpose and potential in the role of international education with an idea toward setting some major policy goals in this particular direction. Sixth, those of you who have been up on campus lately might have observed that our campus's physical image is somewhat tarnished, and unfortunately this in return has a tendency to tarnish our morale and ability to attract students. We now have available approximately $350,000 for a grounds beautification program, and highest priority is being given to that area between Wood Center, Constitutional Hall, and the Greening Building, gravel pit, as it's frequently referred to, and we hope that by the start of the fall semester next year, we will have made some major improvements in this area. Our problems, however, go much further than this. I recently completed a general walkthrough of the entire campus, and frankly, I'm somewhat embarrassed to bring students into some of our dormitories a week from now. Because of some quirks in financing, maintenance in some of these areas has fallen a great deal behind, and some of the dorms, particularly the upper dorms, are in particularly poor shape. I don't mean to be critical of any department within the university, but I am being critical of us as a public institution, and I suppose publicly declare here today that we're going to reverse this pattern of deteriorating maintenance shortly and in the near future. We've taken some short-term steps immediately to provide some funds for new lounge furnishings and a variety of other things to try to make things immediately more attractive, but we need to embark immediately on a long-term program. Additionally, I've spoken with our museum director about extending the concept of a museum throughout the campus, and by the end of this year, we expect to have approximately 25 mini-exhibits in our different public buildings across the campus. We'll be working with the art department toward the display of faculty and student art across the campus, and in general trying to spruce up our overall image. Seventh, and perhaps what appears to be a major permeating problem, is the lack of an identity. That is, an identity as the University of Alaska Fairbanks. Our mission is not synonymous with the University of Alaska mission. We are but a part of this, albeit a major and important part. In my view, this identity crisis exists because less than 10 years ago, the University of Alaska Fairbanks was the University of Alaska, but we have not yet fully made the transition. As a result, I think this particular campus has not stressed and put forward its own unique strengths. And actually, in the last half decade or so, has had some difficulty defining what these unique features are, and therefore we have not capitalized upon them enough. What we must really come to fully realize is that the University of Alaska Fairbanks is the statewide residential campus, the heart of all organized research for the University of Alaska system, but that it is an equal partner with the University of Alaska Anchorage, the University of Alaska Juneau, and that those units are not just branch campuses of this. It is indeed a statewide system of higher education headed by a president with reasonably autonomous campuses throughout. Connected with this, folks, is a reality that those campuses, as well as the community colleges, are competing with us, the University of Alaska Fairbanks, for a finite set of financial resources. You might wish to believe that the state's wealth, that because of the state's wealth, these resources are infinite. This is indeed a myth, and we should quickly dispel it. For the reality is that the governor and the legislature will make a political determination as to how much is going to be spent on higher education in any particular year. The internal disbursement, then, of these funds becomes a competitive process across the various campuses. And for us to compete, our product, that is our education and our research, must be better, more effective, more efficient to justify the increased support. There are those who believe that because the University of Alaska Fairbanks is the oldest campus and perhaps the most developed campus in the system, it requires less than other units in terms of the new resources available. As a result, it seems that it has been held in check somewhat over the past few years so that the less developed units might develop. Because of this, we're now experiencing a number of critical shortages in the areas of instructional equipment. I've mentioned some of the maintenance problems that have occurred. Some of the professional accrediting associations are closely following our professional schools, visiting us more often than we would care to have them visit. In any event, we're going to have to take a look at these and realize that we have got to put forward our best arguments to justify continuing new wealth to the University of Alaska Fairbanks. Additionally, we need to focus ourselves somewhat and again to realize that the entire U of A mission is not the entire mission for the University of Alaska Fairbanks. So we must capitalize on those things that we do well and put them forward. And I would call upon you as leaders in the community to assist us in translating our goals to the public and in obtaining the necessary support to do the job effectively. Finally, there is an increasing educational emphasis on the short-term older adult learner. And this provides perhaps an interesting arena for mutual collaboration between the university and the private business community. In addition to our 3,700 degree-seeking students, which we had last year, the University of Alaska Fairbanks also enrolled over 7,000 continuing education students in our conferences and institutes program. We have a wealth of talent on campus and ready access to additional national and international talent. And if some top-notch conference facilities were available and provided, we could offer a major year-round program which would continue to bring people into this community on a continuing basis throughout the year, even during the dark months of winter. The financing, building, and operation of such a conference institute might indeed be something that could be done by private enterprise with the cooperation and assistance of the university, and I would be very much interested in exploring this with the general community. These are some of our problems, some of my first impressions, and some of the directions that we will be exploring this year. I thank you for your continuing support of our endeavors, and I'm sure that I will be here again seeking it in the future. Thank you very much.
Pat, thank you very much for those interesting comments. I would like to mention that this chamber has a long-standing record of working very closely with the University of Alaska. We look forward to doing that again this year. Also, our bylaws call for the Chancellor of the University and the commanders of Eielson Air Force Base and Fort Wainwright to join our Board of Directors in an ex officio membership status. So we look forward again to having you working with the board during the coming year. Are there any additional comments from any of the membership? If not, thank all of you for coming, and the meeting is adjourned.
Approach to the use of this regional graduate program concept, because it stresses the distinctive mission of a given institution. And so we're very pleased to have these different programs offering students the opportunity to specialize in cold region studies in, for instance, atmospheric sciences, geophysics, marine biology, space physics, and a number of other programs. And we hope that this is one model or one approach to this kind of planning that other institutions will look at in terms of ways in which they can use their distinctive mission
to extend
exactly.
And that's, you're encouraging that.
Yes.
That.
Yeah. Well, the university initiated it, but we will encourage further kind of use of this approach on the part of other institutions that are involved in this program.
Cold weather hasn't stifled creativity.
Cold weather hasn't stifled creativity. The one thing I'd add to that is that the Fairbanks campus, the University of Alaska, is joined with all of the doctoral granting institutions in the five Northwest states in working with WICHE on this approach. We were very pleased at the institutional response to this, because it indicates that there is apparently a need here, or at least a benefit that institutions agree with us can be obtained by this sort of cooperative planning.
There, because further south in Christchurch, there was a light frost this time, but I slept under five blankets and a down comforter while I was there, and that was just about right. But then on Monday, Mrs. Cleverly had outlined a lively program for us. We started out by meeting the Lord Mayor of Wellington first thing in the morning. And then we went on to the university and toured that facility. We had lunch at the Maori Marae while we were there. Then the television cameras arrived and took interviewed some of the students and had some of the kids, the students dancing for them, and then that was on television all week long in New Zealand. And Then in the afternoon we toured another school. Then we went to the Beehive, which is the name that they give to their government buildings, and had tea with Mr. Ken Comber, C-O-M-B-E-R, who's a member of Parliament for New Zealand, on our way down.
Member of Parliament for New Zealand. Of the New Zealand Parliament, or is he representing the English Parliament from New Zealand?
He's New Zealand Parliament. He's for the District of Wellington. And coming down from there, we bumped into the Prime Minister. We were introduced to him. And then that night, we had another one of those traditional South Sea Island Thea Thea celebrations, in which, once again, Duma was the featured performing group. And my guest at that performance was Mrs. Anne Martindale, who's the American ambassador to New Zealand, who, by the way, was most enthusiastic about Duma Theater and its program and the students in it. Then on Tuesday, we traveled by air to Christchurch, where we picked up a bus and went on over to Queenstown, because by this time the students had been performing a pretty heavy schedule. It seemed appropriate to give them some time to themselves. Queenstown is a beautiful resort town on a large lake, which name I can't remember, or probably couldn't pronounce, but I could remember. Surrounded by mountains, very like a lake in the Austrian Alps, and close to the fjord country of west side of the South Island. And we were there for a day. Then we traveled back to Christchurch. And this time our host was Kenape, K-E-N-A-P-E, Faletuese, F-A-L-E-T-O-E-S-E. We once again in Samoan. And our first night there, we didn't have anything to do. But the next day, after we toured the city, we went out to the local teachers' training college and had lunch there and did a performance. And by this time, our tour of the place was coming to a close. So that night, we caught an airplane back to Auckland. Mm-hmm. And when we arrived there, we found almost all of the people with whom we had been billeted or with whom we had made friends before had met our airplane and stayed with us until our airplane took off for Honolulu. And we arrived in Honolulu on a, let's see, we left 10:45 Friday night and arrived in Honolulu 7:35 Friday morning, crossing the international date line again. And
just your luck to get to Friday.
TGIF, advice and whatnot. So in Honolulu, we were hosted by the Youth Theater of Honolulu, and they had a party for us that night. We didn't have to perform. But the next day, we climbed on an airplane and flew over to Hilo, where the University of Hawaii at Hilo had arranged for a performance for us. And the students performed there on Saturday night, once again, to great success. And then on Sunday, we came home. Now,
who put the bill for all this?
Okay, there were two sources of payment here. Our billets and our food while in New Zealand were paid for almost entirely by the people of New Zealand. We stayed in private homes. They fed us. They took care of us in every way, except for the days that we were in Queenstown when we paid our own way. The transportation costs over there and back, we paid for. The legislature appropriated some money for us last year, which was supposed to have covered our traveling expenses last spring. But the money didn't become available until after school was out. And so we didn't use the money for our travels last spring, so we used it for our travels this fall.
Sounds like you had a good time. How
many students did you take? We took 13 students, and our director, Steve Crosby, who was hired to help us get the program together this fall so that we could fulfill some of the commitments that had been made, and I traveled with the group also.
Do you think it was worthwhile trip?
I think that That is a question that can best be answered by the students. I've heard nothing but enthusiastic reports from them. I suppose more than anything, there was that shock of recognition that occurred in their minds and in the minds of the people over there about the ways in which they were similar, in the ways that they looked at nature and the world, for example. The little stories that our students dramatize, for example, are familiar to them, and some of the mythology is not really all that different from our own. It was very like, in the minds of the people over there, it was as though these were distant relatives who had come back to visit them for a change. And I would say the trip was very much worthwhile. In terms of public relations for the university, it was incredible. In terms of public relations for the United States, it was incredible. You have to realize that for the people in New Zealand, the people who live in Alaska are very exotic, and they could not imagine what these people would look like. The first question that I was asked when our airplane landed, we had come out to meet Mr. Ioane and some of the rest of the people. They drew me over to one side and said, now, will these students be able to understand English?
I know people from New York who ask those kind of questions.
But amusingly enough, when we were on our way to Rotorua, the students asked me, will these people be able to understand English? But of course, everybody did. And they taught each other songs and dances, and this invitational dance to which I referred. Everywhere we went, the stage was filled with people who wanted to come up and dance with the kids, with the students. Yes, it was very much worthwhile. This is the kind of representation that our country should always have from the people who travel abroad in its name. And certainly this is the ambassador's feeling. She couldn't imagine any more effective exchange that we could have sent them. Because once again, it took the exotic and put it in terms of that which people could understand, appreciate, and enjoy. And suddenly, these were not people who lived in igloos, although that was the most frequent question, I suppose, that the students were asked.
Although technically they do.
Yeah.
Igloo means house.
Yes, right.
And we do that.
But not this thing made out of snow blocks. What makes it even funnier is that after the students protested, no, we don't live in igloos, then one of the songs that they sing and dance is about building an igloo. So it's difficult to sometimes to persuade people that we weren't really putting them on. But I wonder if I'm just trying to think of episodes or incidents.
Do you have any particularly humorous incidents that happened?
Well, this is what I'm trying to... Well, I can tell you one that isn't humorous, but that gave us a glimpse of conditions in New Zealand and the kind of life they live. When we were in Queenstown, the group was some of the students were walking out to dinner one night. One of the students got his foot caught in the crack and twisted it, and it was very painful for him. So he went back to the hotel. A doctor was called, and the cost of the doctor's house call was $5. The next day, we took this young man to the hospital. Had his foot x-rayed, where it was put in a temporary cast until he could come back to this country, because it was discovered that a bone in his foot was broken, and it cost us $12 to buy him a pair of crutches to walk out of the hospital. That was the only charge to us. So in terms of medical coverage, the people over there pay little or nothing for it. This is completely taken care of.
What were your prices like for meals, for example, on the way out?
Well, we ate out really very little, but it was, let me see if I can think. I suppose a breakfast would have been $5 or $6 and a lunch comparable in price. It depends upon where one ate. Yes.
That's true anyway.
Yes. But some of the things that you could get for that amount of money were rather different. I remember that we stopped at Lake Taupo on our way down to Wellington. We went into some small restaurant or other, and some of the students had a meal that consisted of steak and French fries. This was $4.50. We'd go a long ways to find a piece of steak for that kind of money. But but in the resort town, the prices were a little bit higher. But once again, I suppose you could get a meal for $10 or $12. That sounds pretty familiar, doesn't it? But yes, it's not cheap over there. And the things you'd expect to be cheap, things like woolens and so forth, are not all that inexpensive. But and certainly travel is not. And the country is at the moment not particularly prosperous. There's a great deal of unemployment, but that reflects general world conditions. The people over there are very much interested in the United States and what happens over here. They were very much interested in the election, for example. We were there during the election, and they were absolutely appalled with the results of the election. I did not find anyone who had a good word to say for the man who was elected by the people of the United States. Many of them had seen the final debate between the president and the nominee, and they felt that the Republican nominee was very shallow and lacking in any kind of ability or to think or in hard knowledge of the things that he would need to know in order to be president.
And yet our commentators say that most people think Reagan won. If anybody picked the winner, they say Reagan won the debate.
That's interesting. This was
I mean,
not
these were the commentators.
Yes.
Commentators,
yes.
Right? That's
yeah.
why I'm asking
yeah.
from that viewpoint.
Yeah. This was not perceived that way in New Zealand at all. They were really shocked by what they deemed his equivocation and lack of ability to deal in with concrete facts and with specifics in answer to questions. So they were it was really quite shocking to them. No, they followed it very closely. Another incident I can tell you about, the kinship between the Maori people and the students was very, very close, and the Maoris were very much moved by their contact with our students, so much so that when we departed, George Tate, the Maori elder, presented the group with what is called a talking cane, something that you put down between the two of you. It's intricately carved and decorated. It's a beautiful piece. But he wanted this to come to Duma Theater so that we would remember our Maori friends. The Maori...